Welcome, welcome. We're glad you could make it. You're just in time for the Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Cat Cloco, Ceiling Cat, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould. In our comfy live chat room here at para-x.com, enjoy our various paranormal investigator guests, mediums, authors, cryptozoologists, psychics, ufologists, etc. So sit back, relax with us and the Paranormal View.
And welcome everybody to the Paranormal View right here on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight, those listening in the chat room, and those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. Looks like we've got a whole lot of people already in the chat room and more coming in all the time. If you're listening from somewhere around the world, you can come over to para-x.com. Click on the live chat button, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people, and you'll have a great time by interacting with them and being able to interact with our guest. You'll be able to ask questions and have all the fun that you need. So tonight, we are broadcasting live from the Pry House Museum, and we have to start with tonight with us, we have Barbara Duncan.
Welcome from sunny California.
Fooled you though, didn't I? Went got you first.
Get my mic on.
You wasn't ready. And we got Cat Cloco.
Meow, I'm a cat.
Oh, meow, boy. And we have somebody new with us tonight by the name of Jeffrey Gould.
Hey. I'm back from Missouri. Yay.
Hey.
And we have a whole host full of other people tonight.
It's packed in here.
Some of the special guests we got with us is Douglas McReynolds.
Woo-hoo. He waves. Hello. Doug, you don't wave.
You can hear this, right?
And we got Pat McCormick.
Hello, everyone. I'm smart enough to know this is radio.
This is what you
got to
look forward to.
Yep.
We have had a blast today being out on the Antietam battlefield. And we have tons and tons of stories we're going to be relating about everything that we got today. And we're going to find out about the Pry House.
Yeah.
So you got anything you want to say to start with?
Well, pretty soon I'll be posting photos of my Halloween costume. The only one who dressed up. Yeah. And the ghosts are already going, WTF? What is this thing walking around my house?
They've seen Stranger Things.
Oh, have they?
I promise you that.
Oh, I want to know what these Stranger Things are, because this is pretty strange.
Why?
Yeah, for me. Well, both Tabby Cat and I received our official breakfast food nicknames. I feel like I'm an official radio show host.
That's
now.
Right. That's yeah. Right. Nicknames.
And Henry got his too.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Henry is now known as Molasses because he's so slow. Like Doug, whose name is Syrup.
I would have thought of it because he's so sweet.
Well, I can make some waffles.
Yeah. And yours, Pat, is...
Oh, mine's waffles.
Yeah.
Craig Rupp is pancakes.
Yes.
And so we had to name the two cats that are with us. And
yeah.
Doug, what did you come up with?
Well, Tabby Cat is Fruity, and Cat Cat is Pebbles.
And together, the redheads make Fruity Pebbles.
Actually, Tabby's name, full name, was Fruit Loops.
Yes.
Yes.
Fruit Loops and Fruity Pebbles.
Hey, I'm a blonde. What do you expect?
Well, tonight, because we are from the Pry House Museum, we want to let them tell some stories all about the history and what's going on in the Pry House. And Kat's going to introduce our first guest.
So, yeah, tonight we're joined by, Henry's pointing at me like, that's the mic! That's the mic over there! Speak over there! And I'm like, I have to pick up the notebook.
Yeah, you've never done this before.
Yeah,
you're
no,
totally
this is
new.
The first time for me, Henry. What is this thing? Anyway. It's so shiny. We have Jake Wynn, who is the programming coordinator for the Pry House. And you know a lot of the history, according to all your coworkers out there. Like,
yeah.
Mitch Jake said, he'll go first. He knows all the history. I'm like, okay.
Yep, so, that's my gig here at the museum. And my gig. Yeah, that's my responsibility is to tell all the wonderful history we have going on here. So
I'm sorry, what was your name again? That was
Jake Wynn.
Jake,
yep. I'm the programming coordinator at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine that operates the Pry House here at Antietam.
No State Farm jokes, Jeff.
I what? I don't even know what that
information
means.
I'm not wearing khakis. for all of you viewers out there who are wondering if Jake is wearing khakis, I am not. I'm in jeans tonight. I don't look as good as Kat in her costume over there.
I need to put that up on our Facebook page.
I've never seen mouses with red hair.
I've never been here to the Pry House before. I've never been to Antietam, so this has been a day of firsts for me. So this is a medical museum?
This museum here, National Museum of Civil War Medicine, which operates this, they're based out of Frederick, just a couple of miles east of here. The Pry House Field Hospital Museum is our location out on a battlefield.
Okay.
And so the story that we tell here is really all about the innovation that took place on this battlefield, September of 1862. It is at a crossroads in this war in a number of different ways. This is going to be a turning point. It's going to be a turning point medically for the Union Army. They're going to have a new commander for the Union Army in terms of the medicine. It's going to be a guy by the name of Jonathan Letterman. We really like Jonathan Letterman at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. He gets his first real test here at the Pry House during the Battle of Antietam.
Okay. And I know Tabby Cat, you've mentioned it. He invented the triage ward?
Yeah, so he doesn't invent triage. Triage is something that is a little bit older than the Civil War. Triage dates back to the Napoleonic Wars.
Okay.
The French are going to be the first to utilize triage, and triage is a French word, on the battlefields of Europe. Jonathan Letterman is going to be the first American to bring it to an American battlefield.
Okay.
And very quickly, because it is going to be a very efficient system, and it takes care of wounded men in a way that they had never been taken care of before, it is going to be picked up by the Confederates as well. They're both going to stumble onto this and realize that, you know, they had not been doing the best possible care for their troops. And so this will change the system and actually, you know, save thousands of lives, and also has an impact on modern medicine as well. So this is a story that's tied, you know, going back to the Pry House where we are now, it is tied directly to today because this is the same system we're using on the battlefields with the United States Army, but also here stateside civilian medicine as well.
Now,
and a really cool fact, in the Presidio here at San Francisco, it was the Letterman Hospital,
yes,
which was named after Jonathan Letterman. It's gone now, but the basement was heck haunted. It's now the site of Lucasfilm, but the hospital basement here was incredibly haunted.
Wow.
Letterman.
I seen when we was out on the battlefield, there's something else doing with medicine. And that is where Clara Barton,
yep,
started, and she was affiliated, or ended up, I guess, affiliated with the Red Cross.
Absolutely. Clara Barton is someone that we really love. We love to tell her story. There is a lot more to Clara Barton than meets the eye. Clara Barton, if you ask most people, they're going to say the two things that you just said, that she was a nurse during the Civil War, and that she founded the American Red Cross. And those two things she definitely did. She is an interesting character. She's actually the subject, the person for our third museum, which is the Clara Barton Missing Soldiers Office down in Washington, D.C. Clara Barton, very few people know this. unless they study her closely. She's one of the first women to work for the federal government. She is a copyist. She is picked out for her beautiful handwriting, and she is going to be used by the patent office in Washington, D.C., to make copies of all of the different patents that are being brought in, because in the 1850s, when she's working there, just prior to the Civil War, people are patenting things like crazy, and so they have a need for all the hands that they can get, even women, and they're going to be bringing in Clara Barton. Interesting fact about her is she's going to demand a man's wages. She is going to be the first to do that, and she's going to be one of the first employees of the federal government. But once the war starts, she finds that she can be very helpful out on the battlefields, because the army at the very beginning of the war is very small. The United States Army only has about 16,000 men. In the space of 4 years, they're going to have 2 million men serve in the United States Army. So that very rapid growth is going to mean that bureaucracy is going to take over. It's going to be mired in red tape. Clara Barton is going to unravel that red tape. She's going to cut through it. And she's going to do that by bringing supplies out onto the battlefield. And that's how she lands here at Antietam, is that she actually succeeded in getting a pass from the government, from the army, to pass through the lines and carry medical supplies, food, to the Union troops themselves. And that's how she ends up out at the northern part of the battlefield at Antietam. In fact, taking a bullet through her sleeve, through the sleeve of her dress, killing the man she was actually giving first aid to.
Oh!
Yeah, and he died literally in her arms. He was shot through the head and died in her arms.
Wow.
That's traumatic.
Yep. Sure was. Now, I want to remind everybody that if you do have questions tonight for any of the guests that we have on, you can private chat the questions to either Ceiling Cat, Jeffrey Gould, Cat, or myself, and we will get those questions right over to our guests. Now, talking about the house.
Mm-hmm.
I guess some strange things has happened here.
Yeah. There's some strange happenings here for sure. This is an old building in this area. It dates back a couple decades before the war. You're looking at the building being built in the 1840s by Philip Pry is going to be the owner of the building. He's going to construct it in the 1840s. It's going to see a lot of death. It's going to see a lot of suffering. Both in terms of the soldiers who come here, there are going to be men who die in this building, but then also for the family that lived here too. The Pry family is going to, the war is going to tear them apart financially. They're going to lose all of their cattle, they're going to lose all of, really their household supplies are going to be taken by the army, their farm is destroyed, their mill is destroyed, and they're going to seek recompense from the federal government. It's never going to come to them. And so at the end of this war, they're going to be left in bankruptcy. They're going to be left with an incredible amount of debts. Inevitably, they're going to be forced to move away from here. And I think that really left a strong impression on this building. You can feel it. It is, rife with history. You can just walk in here and you can feel it. I know that... He said it was a little heavy here.
Second floor, boy.
Oh, man. Yep. You can just sense that this is a place where momentous events took place, and it's really true. Because that battle, September 17th, 1862, Battle of Antietam, takes place literally all around this house. And this is where many of the decisions that are going to be made, this is going to be the headquarters for the Union Army's commander, George McClellan. He is going to ultimately decide the fate of the battle for the Union side from this property, from this place. And that's just one of the many, many stories wrapped up here. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of those stories come ringing down the ages to us today.
Well, sounds good.
It's a great story. It's a great story. It's a great place.
So did the house originally start off as like officers' quarters?
You ever anything yourself here, Jay?
Yeah, we have a...
ask the question. I'll
answer the first question. So the house was, so it's built as a farm, and when the war comes here in September of 1862, the property is going to be chosen by the Union Army's high command, specifically Army Commander George McClellan, because it has a commanding view. All of you folks out there listening cannot, you don't necessarily see the vista that we would be able to see here. It's dark now, of course. But when it's
and,
that,
and it's what's and that? it's radio.
And it's radio,
yeah. You can't see it. it's the view from up here. It's sitting on top of a hill, and you can actually see west from here for several miles and what will become this battlefield. So it's chosen by Union Army Command because it gives a very long view of what they think will be the battlefield the next couple of days. And so they set up here. This is going to be their headquarters, and they're going to set up. Some of the officers will be using this as their quarters, sleeping inside, getting out of the weather. And they're going to be making, preparing the barn, which we have a large barn here just outside of the building. They're going to be preparing that barn to become a field hospital. And so preparations are being made for the coming battle that take place inside this property, inside this house, but also all around this area and all the land owned by the Pry family.
I was surprised with how big the barn was.
Yeah.
Because no one mentioned it. In all the barns that I've seen in the Midwest, you get the big ones. There's few of them now. Yes? Well, I was surprised at how large it was.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the soldiers that came here thought the same thing. Mm-hmm. Many of the soldiers who passed through this area, this part of Maryland in the fall, the late summer and fall of 1862, will mention how prosperous this area was during that time. War hadn't come here before. This area was was right at harvest time. And they're looking from the tops of the mountains nearby here and looking down in this area, and they're stunned by how beautiful it is and by how much money it appeared that the farmers around here were making from this from the trade of agriculture. And the barns showed it. The barns in this area were immense. And for the medical service of both armies, they look at that as a great opportunity. There's a lot of space. A lot of space where you can be doing operations and surgeries. And so that's what's going to happen once this battle starts getting kicked up on September 17th, Battle of Antietam. A lot of these barns in this area will be filled to the brim with both the wounded, the sick, and also those surgeons with their elbows covered in blood working hour after hour after hour.
Right.
Man.
Now, you had a question?
Yeah, Kat.
And you got a question. Ask yours first,
please. Well, that's not like... that awesome. Yes, Jake, I was curious to know whether or not, having worked here for a great number of years and so forth, mm-hmm. if you yourself have had any kind of paranormal experiences.
I personally have not. I've worked here, I've worked with the museum for about 2 years. The amount of time I've spent out here at the Pry House has been somewhat limited. However, I will say that you do get those feelings. I've not had anything distinct. I think we'll be hearing some of those stories in a little bit from my coworker, Katie. Other than just a kind of creepy feeling at some times, that's pretty much the only thing that I've personally experienced. I consider myself a bit of a skeptic about the paranormal, but I will say that working at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine in here at the Pry House, considered to be some very haunted locations. I will say that some of the experiences that I've had have shaken that skepticism a little bit.
Yeah, Henry was a skeptic at one time too. Weren't you, Henry?
Maybe a little.
That fact surprised me when he told me that last night. It was like, Henry was a skeptic?
Henry was a big boy. He was... I ain't seen nothing. I don't believe it. If I don't see it, it didn't happen.
That's not the Henry I know.
No.
And that's what surprised me.
Then he met us.
What was your question?
My question was, how many acres does the Pry Farm actually sit on?
At the time, it's stretching over 100 acres. That has the amount of land associated with this property has shrunk over the years as development has kind of taken over. Now it's probably 20, 30, maybe 40 acres. It's not quite as large.
That's how much park system actually
is. The park, this is a bit, the Pry House, around the Pry House is kind of like, it's just one small circle of ground surrounded by development here. The majority of the battlefield is actually about a mile away from here to the west. And that stretches on for thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. But mostly for right around the Pry House, it is just the house and the barn and a couple of fields just around this area that are actually owned by the National Park Service. So the land in this area is relatively, it's in private hands for the most part, with the exception of the house, the barn, and just a little bit of the surrounding area.
Pretty interesting. So what are some of the stories of the spirits and stuff that goes on here?
So we have a couple of people who supposedly are present in the building on a day-to-day basis today. One of them is the wife of a Union Army general. So to tell this story, and I love ghost stories. I love ghost stories because it's like the end around into history. You can tell a ghost story and you can tell the actual history of a place or of a time in our history. And that's what I can do right now. So when this building is being used as a headquarters, as a hospital, this building, the Pry House itself, is going to be used as a hospital for officers exclusively. The barn will be used for the enlisted men. So in here, we're going to see a couple of generals being treated. The first is going to be a general by the name of Joseph Hooker. Joseph Hooker, pretty famous guy. He gets wounded here. He gets shot through the foot during the Battle of Antietam. Actually passes out from blood loss. Wow. He will survive and eventually go on to be the commander of the Union Army. The second general that's treated here is a man by the name of Israel Richardson. Israel Richardson goes down to a wound. He's shot through the chest by a piece of artillery shell, goes through his chest in a section of the battlefield known as the Sunken Road or Bloody Lane, one of the bloodiest parts of the Battle of Antietam. He is brought back by ambulance here to the Pry House. He is taken to the upstairs room, an upstairs bedroom, and that's where he's placed. He's going to be seen by several surgeons. He will linger in the building. His wound is mortal. He will linger in the building for more than a month, and he'll die in early November. In that time...
Actually, I'm looking at Wikipedia. Joseph Hooker died on October 31st, 1879.
Yes. Oh, I did not know that, but that seems...
Happy Halloween.
Yes.
Oh, hello, Mr.
Trick
Hooker.
Or treat.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Hooker.
Mr. Hooker. Hooker's a good cop.
So, but Israel Richardson, so he's up in the upstairs room. He's got this chest wound. It's pretty awful. And so the surgeons are going to realize that he's going to need a lot of help if he's going to survive. They call his wife. This is a general who's originally from Michigan, I believe. His wife's going to come here and try to nurse him back to health. Eventually, Richardson will succumb to his injuries. And it is Mrs. Richardson who is one of those supposedly seen in the building. I will say we do have a presidential connection here at the Pry House as well. While Israel Richardson is down sick, down with his wound, he is visited by Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln comes here to Antietam Battlefield, in October, just a little less than half a month after the battle. He is coming here to Antietam to prod Army Commander George McClellan to get him to move. George McClellan, as Lincoln puts it, has a case of the slows. His move.
What?
Well, this sounds familiar here. Yes. Molasses and syrup.
Yeah. He's a very cautious general. So Abraham Lincoln comes here. He's coming to get McClellan to move the Union Army. He's also coming to visit the wounded Israel Richardson. Israel Richardson is considered to be one of the best commanders in the Army of the Potomac. He leads a division in battle, about 10,000 men. Lincoln comes here and supposedly has a conversation with Richardson that goes something like this. He says to Richardson, "If you get well, I will make you Army commander." That's how highly he thinks of Israel Richardson. That
got a weird impression. Oh, wait, that's not what you meant by go something like this.
Yeah, that's my not a very good Lincoln impersonation. I think I can probably pull out an Abraham Lincoln impression here. I love the movie Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
I just absolutely adore that film.
Yeah.
But now I don't think I can pull it out right now. Maybe I'll come up and warm up a little bit on that one. But but Lincoln comes here and he offers Richardson, if he gets well, he offers him the position of Army commander. But of course, Richardson will perish in the building. And the next commander of the Army of the Potomac, that main Union Army, is going to be Ambrose Burnside, some of the most famous facial hair in American history. He invents the sideburns whiskers that are going to be seen up until now as well. But so we have Mrs. Richardson's one of those people that supposedly is in the building. We have a variety of others that are said to be here as well, men, women, not sure about, I think, one or two stories of children as well. Their identities, I'm not sure of. I'm not sure if anyone is really positive about who they potentially may be. But there are a variety of spirits said to haunt the Primes.
And Katie will have more of that information when we speak to her.
Yep.
Now, I did notice when we come in, it was still a little light when we were waiting outside. Over toward the barn on the side of the hill, you got a big door. You got, what do you call it in there? Meat, was it storage?
Oh, for, the
yeah.
Root cellar?
Yeah, the root cellar.
Yep.
Is that work or is it just...
I'm actually not sure. I have not ever been in there. I'm not sure if that's still open. It's not. I know it's not ever open to the public. I'm not sure if it has collapsed or not. But that was originally their cold storage, essentially, where they would keep try to keep things cold in an era before refrigeration. It is. It looks kind of creepy when you come up to it, I will say. It's like this weird door into the side of the hill right next to this barn, which was being used as a field hospital. So it does have a bit of a creepy vibe. I don't know if, you know, any gnomes or trolls are living in there, but it is pretty good.
Henry need to find out.
Must have really good Wi-Fi to have trolls out there. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Any questions?
No.
Questions for him?
What about Mrs. Pry? I thought she was seen as one of the spirits, and she was so upset because McClellan moved her furniture around.
Yeah, so one of the things about the Army, when they came to a property, especially when they're taking it over like this, they're just doing whatever they see fit, not really caring what the property owner has to say about it. And so George McClellan and his staff come in here, and they just tear the place apart. I mean, they're bringing the Pry family furniture outside. They're sitting in it. They're tracking mud across the floors.
Right.
I mean, they really tear the property apart. And so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mrs. Pry and many of the families in this area are just, I mean, they're going to be upset. They're going to be angry. They're going to be pulling their hair out because there's nothing that they can do because the Army is around this area with 100,000 men with guns.
Right.
They're controlling and they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's going to be wherever these armies go. They're going to be leaving a path of destruction in their way, and not necessarily the way that you think from the Civil War, where you think of battles where you're causing massive destruction. But the Army's just living. Just sitting in one place for too long. They'll tear down all your fences. Your cattle will go wandering off.
Right.
Soldiers are slaughtering the cattle for food. They're tearing down trees. They're cutting down trees for firewood. their ratings, rating sellers stealing food. It's really a disaster for any of the families in the path of one of these armies. And Mrs. Pry is going to feel the brunt of that because she has the head of the army living in her house. And so she has no say whatsoever. And so that would not surprise me.
Sounds like
she's still...
And she refused to leave here, which is they get out. The mm-hmm. person gets out, but she was so, whatever, stubborn. She's like, you know, she just didn't leave, right? So
yeah, and that's something you'll see in other places as well, that there will be some civilians who will stay behind. For the most part here at Antietam, the families got out. It's not as if the armies just suddenly arrived here. It was a very slow process. They could see the armies coming. They could hear the battles that were being fought as the armies approach this area near Sharpsburg, Maryland. And so many of them are going to leave. In fact, there's a really good story of a number of civilians from Sharpsburg, from the town that's close by here, actually going and escaping and hiding in caves along the Potomac River during this battle.
Snyder's Landing?
Snyder's Landing, exactly. Yeah. They're hiding in caves because, there are still artillery shells being lobbed all the way out there, landing in the Potomac River. And so, it's not a battlefield even in the Civil War era, and there's going to be an immense amount of civilian casualties in this war. You don't want to be anywhere close. And Mrs. Pry was here. That's a story right there, just of how, of bravery and also of stubbornness.
Yes, determination, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a couple of emotions coming out there. And once again, this place evokes, you get that feeling of just the strong wills who are here, be they generals, be they civilians, nurses, doctors, across the board. You have a lot of powerful people who have a connection here.
That energy is imprinted on this. You can feel that, this is something where you walk in and it's there. It's right in front of you. You go to the second floor and it's heavier and you understand that this is history. I mean, we're passing through history. This is history.
Yeah, this is a place that, I said it before, you can sense it. You can feel that momentous decisions were made. Army Commander George McClellan is making decisions in battle that are ultimately going to decide the fate of tens of thousands of soldiers. Those soldiers are going to be brought back here to be cared for in the barn. They're going to be struggling for life. You're going to have surgeons down in the barn desperately trying to save lives. They're performing, hundreds of operations, mostly amputations being done. It's a bloody business, and also one that's going to have an impact on all of those who are living at the time, and those in this area, because it is just such a ridiculous event to these people. They had no idea that this war would ever come to their front doors, and here it is in their front yard, in their front parlor.
Yeah. I was talking with you earlier, and you were saying that amputations took less than like 13 minutes.
Yeah, that's one of our favorite stories to tell. One of the most important things that we talk about at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and here at the Pry House is the story of battlefield medicine. And there's a lot of myths associated with medicine of this time period. Some of the listeners out there might be familiar with some of these and might be able to dispel some of the myths associated with medicine of this time period. 95% of surgeries done during the Civil War are going to be done under some form of anesthesia. We have made discoveries in anesthesia in the 1830s with the discovery of chloroform. Chloroform is going to be used by the start of the Civil War in virtually every operation done by doctors in the United States. And so the idea of, let's put a bullet in this guy's mouth, bite down on it, or a wooden stick or something like that, while it may have been true in Revolutionary War medicine or War of 1812 medicine, by the time of the Civil War, we are actually putting people under for surgery. They're not going to be feeling the pain. They're not going to be just given a shot of whiskey and told to hang on and bear with it. But amputations There's going to be 60,000 of them done during the Civil War. Yeah, it's a big number, and a lot of amputees that are going to be around as a result of this conflict. It would take, for an arm amputation, you're looking at 7 to 8 minutes to do that. A good surgeon could do it in 7 to 8 minutes, have it sewn up with a stump and ready to go and start recovery. For a leg amputation, you're looking at 12 to 13 minutes.
Didn't they have? I know that they had bone saws and everything, but wouldn't like a kitchen meat cleaver at least get it started a little better and be faster?
They have. We have many, many surgical kits at the museum. Trust me, many here at the Fry House. They had all the tools that they needed in their kits. It's surprising to me. We actually had. We have a number of surgeons in our volunteer. Staff at the museum. Many of them are associated with medicine. We have an orthopedic surgeon. We have a number of other surgeons who have done operations. And they bring in their equipment. And it is shockingly similar to what they were using at the time of the Civil War. The materials that equipment's made of may be different, but the tools themselves are the same. And so you have a number of different cutting instruments that would be used on flesh, and then, as you said rightfully, the bone saw was a key part of that kit. So a good surgeon's looking at, you know, a couple of minutes to do these amputations. A couple of reasons why doing that: because you have a lot of patients in a battlefield situation. There are a lot of people waiting. Their lives depend on getting quick, accurate care. And so you need to get working on the next patient, but also because the nature of the anesthesia. Chloroform, depending on your body type and the dosage given, will last for about 15 minutes to an hour. So you have a very short time frame to work within so that your patient is still unconscious of what's going on. And I will make a note, surgeries and amputations of this time period, despite there being those myths, and we've kind of busted some of those myths, it's not pretty. It is far from pretty. This is an era before we know about germ theory. We do not know what causes infection. And so we're not cleaning our instruments. And so what they're going to do is they're going to wipe off their instruments, which are covered in blood and the matter of the previous patient. They're going to wipe it down with a bloody rag, run it through some bloody water, and then they're going to start on the next patient. And so ultimately, whatever was in the patient that came before will be passed to the next patient and the next patient.
So you really wanted to be number one.
You really wanted to be number one, yeah.
I'm just thinking, congratulations.
I volunteered.
Yeah. Where did that come from? Yeah, so it's that's the part of Civil War medicine that is really, truly accurate. We know that they're not cleaning their instruments because they don't know about sterilizing their tools. They don't know about, how this infection is passed from person to person yet. And that's why the Civil War is especially a sad case, because it occurs at this time just before we make major discoveries in medicine. Even while the war is going on, you have guys in Europe like Joseph Lister, Louis Pasteur, who are going to make huge inroads in understanding what causes disease. They're going to be looking at through microscopes and see these tiny little organisms. That's the root of disease in humans. Mm-hmm. But at the Civil War time frame, they're not understanding that yet. It's an unfortunate part of the war that it occurred just a few decades too soon. Many, many more lives could have been saved.
Well, pretty much it was sad it happened at all as opposed to when.
Yeah.
If this happened years from now, we'd be...
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, though, looking at this war, it was inevitable. It's an inevitable conflict that had been brewing for years and years and years, this political conflict that eventually would break out into actual fighting. So the Civil War, it is so unfortunate that estimates now put 700,000 people dying as a result of this conflict. But in medicine, it actually pushes the ball forward. There's going to be a lot of discoveries being made through this war. the way surgical operations are done, because these guys have so much practice, by the end of the war, American surgeons are going to be considered some of the best in the world. They have created innovative new ways of performing operations. In fact, the method that they use to do an amputation of a limb is actually the same way we do it today. The circular method is a way of actually creating this stump that we would see on people today if for whatever reason amputation was the course of action needed today. It's the same method that they are perfecting during the Civil War. It also pushes things forward in the way of prosthetics. Remember, 60,000 amputees. And so prosthetic limbs is going to become a huge industry. There's one company specifically I'm thinking of, the Hanger Company. Comes about, they have a business at the time of the Civil War and are still doing prosthetics today.
Oh, wow.
And so that is something that has come down the ages and is still impacting medicine.
Making an impact.
Yeah.
And not just on that side of it, too, but Smithsonian Magazine just came out with an article about the Civil War embalmers who made it a business of going into the people that could pay to have their sons, husbands, et cetera, come back to them and be buried locally. They would do embalming in the field as well. They used arsenious acid. So they're saying that a lot of the Civil War graves now are just filled with arsenic.
Ew.
Yeah.
Embalming. Don't be drinking the worried water around there.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, embalming, that's actually the story of our museum in Frederick. That was an undertaking business. And that's why the museum is located there, because it was a furniture store and undertaking business, so a lot of space in that particular building. But you're right, embalming is going to come around as a result of the Civil War. It wasn't something that was done in America prior to the conflict. And in an era before the discovery of formaldehyde as a preserver in corpses, they're using all kinds of chemical concoctions, mm-hmm. arsenic, lead, mixing all of these different chemicals together in order to try to cobble together something that will keep the body together so they can transport it, as you said, home to families. Because that was a huge thing that in Victorian America, there's these very specific ways that you died. Prior to the war, you die at home. You die surrounded by friends and family. They're there to see you off to the next world. And suddenly, with the Civil War breaking out, you have these huge battles and thousands of men dying, nameless and unknown, buried in unknown graves, and their families never know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And embalming provides a way of giving comfort to some of these families, that they can place the bodies on rail cars and send them back to places that are hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away from the battlefield. It's a real godsend for a lot of these families, because they can actually get and retrieve their family member's body and give them a proper burial.
Yeah. Now, something that was brought up in the chat room that made me think of a question. Aussie Jeff mentions,
yay.
Yeah, one of our listeners in Australia was like, well, there must be body parts all over the battlefields. But that made me think, if the barn was a triage unit, there has to be a medical waste pits around the property. Have you guys found any?
I don't know of any found here at Antietam, here at the Pry House at Antietam. I know that they have been found in other locations.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually, I can relay a story from back in Frederick.
Okay.
So as a result of this battle, Battle of Antietam sees 23,000 casualties in a single day's fighting. It's the deadliest day in American history. 10,000 of those wounded and sick are going to be brought back to the city of Frederick, which once again is about 20 miles east of here. They're going to take on those wounded. They're going to be put in all the churches, schools, civic buildings, mm-hmm. are going to be filled with these wounded men. And many of them are going to be having amputations being done even back at those hospitals miles away from the battlefield. What they would do is exactly what has been depicted in many different kinds of popular culture.
Yeah.
You're looking at limbs being cut off, piled up, and buried outside a window.
Yeah.
In fact, we found one. I had a newspaper clipping being brought in by someone who was interested in this kind of thing, brought into the museum about a hospital in Frederick. He had found a newspaper thing from the 1880s, so 20 years after the war, when they were doing adding on to a section of the building. They came across one of these waste pits.
Yeah.
One of these pits where they were just arms and legs buried.
Yeah.
And they would be seen at any Civil War hospital site. Where there are amputations being done.
Yeah.
I know that there are famous cases of them being found quite recently at Gettysburg College, because the college was actually being used as a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They've been found there. They've been found all over the place where these battles and where these hospitals were located. So they were just really, they were removed, thrown onto piles, and then those piles were either buried or burned.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, that was the fridge behind me.
Yeah, the Landon House. We investigated the Landon House in Urbana, and that was also actually, you could see the physical area where the ground was lower. Because, of course, this stuff decomposes, and then as that happens, the ground caves in, and you've got this, like, pit
yep.
there. Yeah.
Well, in Cincinnati, they're not medical waste pits. They're the old latrine pits that you would have in the urban cities. And we had cultural resource management archaeologists come in, and after everything had decomped enough where you could pull stuff out, you got guns, whiskey bottles, plates, all sorts of interesting things. And there's a display in the museum of just, look at all the booze and stuff we found, because Cincinnati was a mobster. Whoa, a mobster... running city. Henry's playing with the audio, and suddenly I had this really weird vocal effect, and I'm like, oh, I'm in outer space.
Okay. I know the other two co-hosts that we have that's on with us, Jeffrey is from Los Angeles. He's an actor out there. And Barbara Cece is from San Francisco. So we have two on the West Coast and two over here. So just wanted to let you know who was asking you questions.
Yeah,
they're looking just, and nobody in here is asking the questions.
Coming out of the ether. I don't know. I just, yeah, it's just voices in my head.
telling you to kill everyone.
Duly noted.
Does anybody else have any more questions for Jake?
No, I got one comment from our chat room, and it's from Actress, and he says, hooray for the history of amputation and formaldehyde.
Yeah, this is the good stuff. It doesn't get any better than this.
That's right.
Well, we're going to take a quick little break, and we want to thank you for this. I know you're going to be taking some people around and showing them the different places and trying to scare the crap out of them.
Yeah,
so
you're taking us to the barn, aren't you?
Oh yeah, the barn.
He's going to the barn.
No,
so
the barn.
We've got another one coming in.
Yes, Katie.
Katie will be coming in here right after break. We'll talk with her. And then Pat and Doug
you mean
and
these two?
All of us, yeah. We got lots of
waiting for you all over the battlefield all day.
Yeah.
We got lots of stories that we'll try and get in.
And Doug and, will wave to you some more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're gonna be doing some investigating too. So
we got stuff.
Jake, by the way, is Jake still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Do you have any kind of like a website or any kind of thing? I found your name on one of the national park sites, but it's not like any kind of hey, it's Jake, you know, kind of link.
Yeah, you'll find me, the official website for the National Museum of Civil War Medicine is civilwarmed.org. That's where you'll find information about me and information about all of the lovely things, all the lovely topics we talked about tonight. Find out more information there. And come visit us. All of your listeners.
Oh, yeah, I'll be right there.
World. We love having people coming from all over the place. To
okay.
come learn about Civil War medicine.
If I had a functional TARDIS, I'd be there already.
Yeah.
All right.
We got a DeLorean for you, Jeff.
There we go.
But that would just have me here. See, that's what's cool about the TARDIS. It travels anywhere in time and space.
Well, we're
great Scott!
Well, we're going to go ahead and take a break, and we will be back probably in just about 5 minutes. Won't be real long. So stay tuned. Kat's going to take us out.
All right.
And Cece will bring us back.
Meow, 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 meow. No, everyone, you're listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Cat Cloco. Tonight, we are live, our Halloween episode at the Pry House. With Pat and Doug of the Ghost Soldiers.
All right.
And paranormal author, Cat Gash, who waves. More to come after the break.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio and the all-new Para-X Vision can help. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio and Para-X Vision. Programming for the open mind.
You know, there's nothing like a great memory of a great time. And if you grew up during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, boy, have we got the memories for you. There was no time more innocent than the 1950s or 60s, nor was there a time more politically explosive. Hi, this is Steve Shockley, a.k.a. The Shock. Join me live every Friday and Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern for a Baby Boomer Rock with a Shock sock hop on Rock with a Shock. Radio.com.
Para-X Radio presents Real Persons of Genius.
Real Persons of Genius.
Today, we salute you, Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Armed with nothing more than a laptop and a microphone, you hit the air to scare the bejesus out of your audience.
What the hell was that noise?
Like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant, you always whet our appetite for more.
I just can't get enough.
Whether it's witches, ghosts, fairies, or Bigfoot, we admire your ability to set aside reality and believe anything anyone tells you.
Seek professional help.
So the next time you're kneeling in front of your 8x10 glossy of Dave and Tom lighting a candle, remember, if it wasn't for you, I might be able to sleep without the lights on.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X Soho.
Para-X Radio Network, powered by CBS.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View. We want to thank you for joining us on this wonderful Halloween evening for more blood, gore, and guts, more famine, and an occasional pop top from somebody drinking on the other side there.
Who? Was that the Dr. Pepper?
Yeah, somebody opened a Dr. Pepper. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, sure. Okay.
This show is not endorsed by Dr. Pepper.
We got another guest that we're going to be having come on in just a minute, and Kat's going to introduce her. But I want to make sure that if you do have questions, you can private chat them to either Ceiling Kat, Jeffrey Gould, Kat, or myself, and we will get the questions right over.
And you can email them to theparanormalview@gmail.com. However, unfortunately, this Halloween, please don't tweet them over because I can't log on to our Twitter.
Yeah.
You can still tweet to it. I mean, I tweet to
She can read it, though, so it doesn't do any good.
Yeah. But you can tweet them over to my personal Twitter account, which is just, at Kloko, with KatKlockow.
Because you can do that on your phone.
Yeah, well, right. I can do it on my laptop.
Say, do you find something odd there? You can't get to the website, but you can get to your personal tweet site?
Well, that's because the password's not saved, and I can't remember what it is right now. There's so much going on.
Okay.
Why are you pointing at me?
Why don't you introduce our guest?
Sure. So, right now we have Katie Reichard. Oh, crap. I just...
That was quick.
Reichard.
There is... Yes, Riker. Katie
Riker. She can't read and write.
I can't read and write. What am I doing with my life? Anyway, the reservations coordinator, and you know all the ghost stories. Not all.
I
good amount of them.
Yeah, I do know more of them, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. I want to let you know that we have two other co-hosts that are not here.
They are not ghosts.
No, they're not ghosts.
That I know of.
One is in Los Angeles, which is Jeff.
Hello.
Say hi, Jeff.
I said hi. Hello. Well, I said hello. So, hi.
And we have Barbara Duncan, known as Cece. She's
San Francisco. I'm just a disembodied voice.
Just in my head. It's fine.
He was sitting there, and all of a sudden, somebody's asking questions, and he's looking and ain't none of us talking.
That was funny.
So, I just wanted to let you know that. So, go ahead with what you were saying about, you was asking a question about the ghost.
No, I wasn't.
You did. You said something.
You were thinking it really hard.
I was talking about Twitter.
She had a question.
Yeah, actually.
Sorry, what was that?
He asked you to introduce our guest.
Yeah, that was the last thing. Oh, well. So happy Halloween, everyone.
What's some of the things that happens here?
All right, well, I think one of the most prominent stories actually goes back to the 1970s when part of the Pry House actually burned.
Yeah, just get closer to the mic.
Okay, sorry.
No, so, it's so everyone can hear.
So in the 1970s, the Pry House is at that time being used as housing for Antietam Battlefield. And one night it caught on fire. And as the fire department was coming in the lane, they thought they saw a woman on the second floor. So instead of immediately focusing on trying to save the house, they needed to get inside to try and save the woman. By the time they made it into the house, they realized that the second floor had long collapsed prior to that. And so for that reason, more of the building burns than what otherwise would
happen. Wow. So they thought they seen a woman, but there was no floor there by then. Yes.
And that is where General Robertson was treated. So it's believed that it's possibly Mrs. Robertson that still has remained behind.
Wow.
Now, Mrs. Pry... really loved the house, right?
Yes.
Does anybody ever see her here still?
Yes, though I believe most of the stories about her, it's normally on the first floor of the house. We were actually talking about how a lot of the stories are in more of the front of the house on the first floor. And in that case, there are stories. One girl actually said that she saw someone in a period dress that walked by her. And it was actually our executive director's daughter at the time. And she walked over and asked her dad, who was in the house in period dress, and looked at her and said, there's no one else here. So that is one of the stories. Mrs. Pry did love the house. Unfortunately, they would end up moving after the Battle of Antietam. They stayed for a few years, but financially they just weren't able to recover. So.
Are you playing with the camera? Are you going to ask a question?
Henry, I am watching like three different things right now.
She
got to
add a camera to make it better.
Yeah.
Where is one of the... you might say hot spots in the house that's the most haunted, you might say?
A lot of the stories are on the second floor, both in the Richardson room, and also there's a room that is directly across as well, and people just say that they don't really like going in there. Occasionally they do hear footsteps from that room as well. Now in regards to voices, normally those tend to be coming from the first floor. We do have stories from two of my coworkers who were here off season. They were working in the office upstairs, and they heard someone say very distinctly, "I'm here." And so they both panicked slightly because no one else should be here. And so they came downstairs, they walked through the house, they walked around the house to find out if there was a visitor trying to get in, and no one else was on the property.
Hmm. Do you have any visitors that come here that see anybody in period clothing and say, like, wow, I didn't know there were reenactors here or something like that?
That's, I haven't heard any stories of that happening. It certainly doesn't mean that it hasn't happened before. Right. I just haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you do have people that does come in. Do they come in through the week to investigate or just on the weekends?
Well, we occasionally have people come in. Normally, well, we're actually currently only open on weekends unless it's by special request for a tour of the exhibits. So that would be the only available time.
Yeah. And what kind of activity takes place in the barn?
In the barn, in a lot of cases, they say that they can hear voices in the barn. There are people moving around. It sounds like it's... it was used as a field hospital, so they mm-hmm. can hear the sounds of people being treated within the barn.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, do a lot of people come to the Pry House, like spectators and visitors, since the battlefield is right over? Do a lot of people know about this place?
Well, we do wish that more people knew about us. We're kind of detached from the actual battlefield. You have to go slightly off, down, heading towards Boonesboro to reach us. So normally we only see a small portion of visitors that are coming into the battlefield.
I know that they have a thing down in Sharpsburg down here of ghost tours. Do they ever bring people up this way on the tour?
Normally not, though. That's actually stays just within the town
within
limits.
The town? So what are you guys doing to, are you trying to promote the ghostly activity here, or to try and get more groups in or more people wanting to come to investigate?
I think we like to coexist with the ghosts that are here, that they can do their own thing and we'll continue to be here to interpret the history as well. It's always nice to have groups in like this because it does raise awareness of the location. Mm-hmm. And really, I think any reason for someone to come to the museum to experience history, that's what's important. So if they come here because they're looking for a paranormal experience, then they can learn something at the same time.
Well, and we love history. One of the things about our group is Doug and I really like the history. And we have to know the history first, you know, to understand the property or the whatever site you're at. So we're just lovers of history. So the paranormal's not like icing on the cake, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a beautiful building. Now, the thing that I always have a question about, and this is not specific to this house, but it has the double exposed porch area. We're in the kitchen, which is part of it. Was this a common architectural point for houses? Do any of us know?
Would this be like a summer kitchen, maybe? Because a lot of houses of that era had a what they called the summer kitchen, you know, which originally was a porch, and they enclosed and made into a kitchen that wasn't in the main house. So
you mean for the summer or for the winter?
For the summer.
For the summer.
It's so hot in the summer that you don't want to have the main fireplace.
Right. Usually the summer kitchen was away from the house, kind
sometimes
of.
Sometimes it was.
Right.
Sometimes it was attached, like an attached porch or part of the building.
Now,
like the hall.
Actually, the summer kitchen, the foundation, when we're walking around the side of the building, that is directly behind us here.
Oh, okay, so, so it's out, it's away from the house.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, at Uncle Mike's house, he lives in the furnace house, and his house is here, and there's actually a summer kitchen that sits up off to the left. But the front door takes you out, and then you go up a few steps and make a left, and you go into the summer kitchen.
Huh. Yeah, but like the Haldeman Mansion, they had a huge indoor cook-in fireplace. And next to that was a kitchen that they used because in the summertime, it was too hot, you know, to have that whole room filled up with the fire and stuff going. And so they, you know, until they built a separate summer kitchen, there was one off to the side. But
yeah, and like, in Indiana, I know there's a few locations that I've visited for different paranormal events, and the second story that would be above this, it would be the
slave quarters.
No, it's it's quarantine. If somebody was sick, they would be quarantined in a bedroom above the, this kitchen.
Really?
Let's say if it was this building. Yeah.
Huh.
Hmm. Yeah, weird. But I guess it could be the servants' quarters too.
Yeah,
a lot of times you get it for servants' quarters.
Okay.
So are you going to be taking the people out to the barn or just here in the house tonight?
I don't think Jake and I have discussed it, but we can do it either way. I don't mind going out to the barn.
Maybe Jake can do the barn.
I'm not going to be opposed if he wants to take the barn.
You're aware this is a family show, right? I'm just saying.
You're worried about him taking her out to the barn or something? Or
taking her out to the barn?
I don't know what you're talking about, Jeff.
Oh, of course not.
We've already talked about hookers tonight. So.
Yeah. So where do you recommend that they start investigating? Upstairs? Downstairs?
Apparently Henry is not investigating. Are you okay, Pat?
I guess someone is trying to look out. Can you set a ghost up for us in the second floor? And tell us to go
can
there?
You prop them up?
Henry, whatever plans you make, throw them out the window. Unless you've been doing this, like, you know, while you know that whatever plans are going to go right to hell and that you just go with whatever happens.
No, Henry's plan is for all of us to do an investigating. And he'll just sit here
right.
and eat chocolate.
That's right.
And
eat
drink
chocolate.
His soda.
Yep.
And
not me. I would
so
do.
Wired tight with equipment right now. There's not an inch left.
Yeah, he can't move.
Well, and I think we marched Henry around the battlefield a little too much. And quite frankly, he's going AWOL on us.
Oh, that's what's happening. Okay.
No, I'm going to investigate too. But
okay.
I didn't know how they was. If you guys. Are all going to go together, or some of you's going to go to the barn at one time?
We'll probably split up, into two smaller groups.
We will send you through here alone.
The house, one's going through the barn. And then we switch back and forth.
Well, you got to switch all you want to. I'm staying in the house. It's cold.
Cane over there in the corner, Henry.
It's cold out there.
I know what we'll do, guys. Boom. We'll bundle him up. Put a camera on him and send him alone into the barn.
Is there a
little cocoon?
Henry loves basements. Do you have a basement here?
We do have a basement.
Yeah, there we go. Stay in the house.
House basements after dark. Can't go wrong with that.
Well, it's a dirt basement, too, so, I mean, it's a little bit extra creepy down there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's perfect for him.
No. Me and basements do not get along.
You'll be in the house.
Me and basements do not get along.
Is there an attic then?
There is an attic.
There you go, too. Henry. You have a second choice.
Me and attics don't go.
Henry, you're getting off the first floor. Trust us.
All right. So let's get back to the questions here.
All right.
Yeah. Have you seen anything in the house?
I have not. I'm normally actually at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine in Frederick. So most of the stories I have are coming from coworkers who have been pretty alarmed at times.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wait, you didn't tell about the car story yet.
Oh, yes. One of the gentlemen who used to work specifically here on weekends, and he was the biggest non-believer that you could ever meet. And he used to actually sleep here overnight because he lived closer to D.C. and it was so far to travel. And one night while he was asleep up in the office area, he heard three distinct voices from the first floor, and he heard people walking around, and he heard the door open and close, and then heard the three distinct voices again. And by the time all of that was over, he had piled everything up in the office, just right in front of the door to make sure nothing was getting through to get to him. And he continued, of course, not to drive all the way back home to DC, but instead from that moment forward, he would sleep in his car every night instead of sleeping in the house.
Wow. Really? Wow. Yeah.
So we got a question from chat room.
Yes. Yeah. Jeff down in Aussie wants to know if they're...
Aussie Jeff had asked.
There was something right here by the door. Said something.
Oh.
You guys didn't hear it.
I was not paying attention to the question.
We did.
Okay, so.
All right. Ask your question.
The slow folks. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to scare the ghost away. Yeah. Aussie Jeff in the chat room wanted to know if there are any tunnels that come in or out of the property via the cellar.
No, as far as I know, there aren't any tunnels that are going to and from the cellar.
Okay.
Yes, and the cellar is not too far from there, but as far as I know, there aren't any that are going between.
Okay, I have placed a REM pod in the place of the alleged whispering.
Yes. Yeah, it was more over by the door over itself.
Sorry.
But that's okay.
I put it so we can all see it.
It's got a 5-foot radius in the door.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow, that's as tall as me.
Yeah.
Now, we're hoping that we're going to be able to get some activity tonight. Is that what you guys are really looking for? Is evidence that confirms some of the things that...
Yeah, I'd like... Certainly like to see it. There have been so many stories over the years, it'd be nice to have some actual confirmation.
Yeah.
So how often do you actually get a group that will come in here to investigate? Have they ever showed you anything that they've caught?
Well, we only allow so many paranormal groups to come in a year. And so that is actually normally set at about 2 a year. Occasionally we do more than that, but everything has to go through a selection process with our executive director.
Apparently we've done pretty good getting in here.
Okay, so back to the tunnel thing for just a second here. And I wonder why there would be one, but... What's the history of the farm after the Civil War? Was there any events that were happening then?
Sorry. We have been, Barbara, there are black beetles everywhere. I'm watching them climb up the curtain.
I could just see Henry leaning over.
And there was one. Yeah, there was one crawling up his mic. I've been watching it all evening, actually, wondering when he would notice.
And
sorry.
For an hour and 15 minutes, this beetle has been crawling on his microphone, and he just hit it with the hat, his Ghostbusters hat.
Now
he's running away.
He's completely flummoxed. Uh-oh. I'll take the towels. That'll help.
Its carcass is on his computer, that's why. So, Barbara, please ask that question again.
I was asking whether or not what the history was after the Civil War, and is there any? I'm sure that the house was lived in before it became a museum. Are there any stories from that era?
In regards to that, after the Civil War, the Pry family did continue to live in the house for a little while afterwards. I don't actually know too much of the history beyond it eventually becoming National Park Service property. And at which point employees started living in the house.
Oh, wow. So and, any stories from that?
Well, that is partially where the story of the woman in the second floor is coming from.
Okay.
Once again, they're coming to us with the same stories. Occasionally, we have someone who used to live in the house that comes in to see it. And they'll mention the footsteps that they would hear at night when they were trying to sleep. Occasionally they say they would hear doors opening and shutting on their own.
A dowsing rod?
Voices? Do they hear voices?
Yeah. I don't think they could ever actually make out the conversation itself, but they would be able to hear someone in the house speaking.
Yeah. I've experienced that before. They're like, you know that there, it sounds like a conversation just going on in the next room, but you know you're actually the only person in the house. Yeah.
I assume that Tabby Cat is already investigating out there. She's, I don't know where she went to, but she's out in the house.
She's taking your cat.
Yeah, something like that.
She was in one of the front rooms earlier doing some investigation already.
Okay. Have you guys got any more questions that you want to find out about the house right now?
Well, the chat room is still going on about hidden tunnels or bunkers around the house. And I don't think there are any.
I fear it might be fairly anticlimactic in regards to that.
There's a root cellar, and that's all you got, folks.
That's it. And that's not connected to the house. So that's out near the barn.
Yeah.
I think for right now, what we're going to do is go ahead and take a quick last break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Pat and Doug and maybe
stuff.
Get Tabby in here or something. And I know somebody's already wanting to do some investigating. So we're going to finish talking about what we found on the battlefield today.
Yeah.
And some of the things that took place last night in a hotel room.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
It's rated PG, everyone.
I was going to say, hey, let's not go there.
Everybody's in.
Everyone got worried. That's what happened.
So, with that, I'm going to. Who took us out before?
Me.
Jeff will take us out, and CC will bring us back. How does that sound?
Yeah, I'm back. Usually, second break and all that stuff. I just got to get used to it. By the way, I was on a battlefield last Sunday. We can talk about that later. But right now, you're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with hosts Henry Foister, Cat Cloco, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould. Tonight with Pat McCormick, Doug McReynolds, Cat Gash, somewhere, Jake Wynn, Katie Ricard, et al. So stay tuned for more of Paranormal View after the break.
Attention, attention, humans of Earth. This is a message from Scaro. You are tuned to para-x.com for the paranormal view. Random sounds you call music is about to be generated for a period of approximately 500 rels, after which the paranormal view will resume. You are to stay tuned to prevent your being exterminated. Transmission ends.
Good news, everyone!
We're back, baby!
That's right, we're back! Hi, I'm Pat McCormick, and Ghost Soldiers Radio is back! We're teaming up with The Shock on Rock with The Shock Radio, and we are on a mission.
We're on a mission from God.
A mission to play great music and have fun.
God be praised.
Ghost Soldiers Radio starts May 16th at 10 p.m. on rockwiththeshock.com.
Hey, kid, you like music?
Sure.
Good.
So if you like music, join us as we move on up. Saturday, May 16th at 10 p.m.
Well, we're moving on up.
So join us May 16th at 10 p.m. for Ghost Soldiers Radio, only on rockwiththeshock.com.
We finally got a piece of the pie.
Yes! I
Yuma's sacred cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron!
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going!
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hi, this is Hollywood haunt writer Marla Brooks, and you're listening to the Para-X Radio Network.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They all talk gobbledygooky, the Para-X family. The shows are paranormal, not stuffy but informal. The topics are abnormal, the Para-X family.
They're strange, deranged, unrestrained.
So grab your favorite brew, it's time to rendezvous, as we give awards to the Para-X family.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View live Halloween show tonight. There's an investigation going on, ghosty hunting, and we want to thank everybody from joining us in the chat room and from all over the world. And tonight we have listeners in the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Norway, Belgium, Germany, and Unknown is back.
It works better if I turn the mics on.
Probably, yeah. We were wondering if we had to do EVPs or a Ouija board just to be able to get a conversation going.
So we had lots of listeners from around the world, and we have lots of listeners here in the chat room, and I want each and every one of them. If you do have questions tonight, you can private chat them to Ceiling Cat, Jeffrey Gould Cat, or myself, and we will get those answered for you. Yep.
And you can send chocolate to us for trick-or-treating.
Yeah, that would be great. Lots of that, because we have to stay here and do the show. We can't go out trick-or-treating. So.
Well, as promised, everyone, I am wearing a Halloween costume, and I am a tabby cat.
Yay.
Huh. Believe it or not, she was the only one who wore a costume.
I can't believe it. I like half the photos I took of him. He's on the phone with somebody.
Yep, yep.
Walking around the battle. I'm like, how are you getting signal? Because my phone did not get signal.
Well, anyway, do you want to start with what took place last night or on the battlefield today?
Last night.
I'll take last night for 100.
Last night. last night we went out to dinner, and Kat didn't get here in time for that, so she was already at the hotel. We had to go pick her up, and we all went back over to where Doug and Pat was staying, and we thought everything was cool. They had a few beers and all.
I drove past where they're staying, and it's a really impressive architecture hotel.
Yeah, the Bavarian Inn.
And I'm driving past, I'm like, why are we there? Because it just looks so cool. And I was like, what, established in the 20s?
Yeah, and actually, the land goes back, the
to the 1800s there, the property, but the house that is now the reception area was a family house in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was bought sometime in the 40s by Amish people. And it's great. It looks like you're in Switzerland. It's got that, you know, architecture and beautiful chalet lodges kind of thing that overlook the Potomac River.
Yeah.
We have a balcony, which we were all on last night. Thank God it held up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we had a 100 feet, we're above the Potomac, 100 feet.
Yeah.
And you can see the Potomac, the bridge, the highway bridge, and the railroad bridge. It's beautiful. What a fantastic scenery.
Yeah. And so because we were so close to the Potomac, Tabby Cat and I kept picking up on people.
Whoa, hello there.
Hi there, Jeff.
Just picking up you guys. She didn't know. Yeah.
No.
Doing shots. All right.
That's not what I meant. You're twisting my words.
No.
I didn't know the Potomac went that direction.
It goes both
ways. It goes both ways.
I knew it's in D.C. That's the extent of my knowledge of the Potomac. I didn't know where, into what state it went. Well, I really don't know its geography.
Actually, in West Virginia, the Bavarian Inn is actually over the border in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're about 4 miles from Antietam, where we're at now. So, yeah, it's all close.
Yeah, it is. But to make a long story short, we were picking up on a murder victim who was dumped in the river.
Yeah.
We did that. And
we
then,
did that?
Yeah, we did
murdered
that.
Him?
And then.
Wow, Henry.
Then
we
there
murdered
was,
him.
There was people in the house then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In the room with us.
Doug was doing a Captain Morgan's pose, and
yes.
I took a picture, and there are three distinct orbs above him that weren't in the photo before or the photo after. And Henry's like, well, that picture over there. I'm like, well, Henry, you take a picture and see if you get anything. And Henry didn't pick anything up, so it wasn't a reflection. And then later on, we got more, and they've all moved around the room. And that's when we started picking up. He's here with us, and, you know, feel somebody in the room. And I guess Kat got to think about the murder.
Yeah, it was both of us, I think.
Yeah, we both picked it up.
Yeah. And the guy trying to get his name, kind of still murky on that.
Right.
Yeah. You were other sensing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was one around.
I did. I watched the shadow man cross through the wall, and it went across the hallway into where your bathroom would be. So basically, for our listeners, I was looking at the door into the room, and I watched the shadow man come the wall from the right hand side, and it walked down the little hallway across on the left hand side, which went to the restroom. And I just watched him, and it just darted right across.
Yeah,
it could have been part of that hallway.
Well, and interestingly enough, this morning when we were getting into our car, we ran into one of the workers at the very inn.
Mm-hmm.
Noticed a ghost soldier's, you know, jacket. What's that? And I told them, paranormal investigators, and Kevin, if you're listening, hello out there. He does a great job over at the Bavarian Inn. He's the maintenance guy. And once I explained to Kevin that we had some stuff happening in the room last night, he goes, oh, now this makes a lot of sense. And I said, I'm guessing you've had a lot of stuff maybe disappear and then show up again or move or things won't work. And he's like, something. He goes, I thought I was crazy. I can't tell anybody, but yeah, stuff disappears, and, you know, then it shows up again. So, Bavarian Inn actually is built on the inn that saw the Battle of Shepherdstown wounded brought up there. So the entire property that these chalets and lodges are built on was another Civil War hospital.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So.
That may have been why you and I kept smelling death, decay.
Yeah, we kept smelling decay. And then a very real world skunk.
Yeah.
Real world skunk.
I'm sure there wasn't.
Okay, who just said so?
Who said what?
What?
So.
So?
Did somebody just whisper so?
You mean like...
No, not I.
so
okay.
Like Joe
saying something.
Like somebody saying, oh, maybe like so.
Oh, like so.
No, it was so.
I didn't hear it, but mark it. We will listen to it on the replay and see if we catch anything. That's Jeff doing that.
What? Doing what?
You're too close to your microphone.
I was on mute. I just turned it back on when you accused me of something.
Really?
It's not me, because my mic's off.
One of us around it here. Must be Kat, then.
Which one? There's two of us here.
You're sandwiched in between two cats again.
All right, we'll try and be a little bit better so there's not so much static and stuff going on.
So we had a lot of stuff happen today.
A lot happened today. Kat was taking notes of different things that happened and where. So if you want to say some.
Well, we started around the visitor center, and then we went to the Dunkard Church.
Yeah.
And Dunkard Church is a religious sect, the Dunkards, and they actually built this church before the battle, and it was right in the middle of the battlefield, so it suffered cannon fire and all kinds of things. It later burns down, and they rebuilt it, and they actually used some of the wood from the original church. So that was pretty cool to be in there, and you could definitely, it was very quiet inside.
Yes, it was.
And we probably got EVPs, but there were people coming in and out, so yeah. We couldn't really go through it. But one of the places people forget to visit is the West Woods.
Yes.
Where some of the severe and huge fighting happened on September 17th. So I took them back there, which is behind the Dunkard Church, and I explained to them some of the stories that I had heard about the confusing things that happened and some of the wounded people, like Sergeant Bloomer, I think, from the 1st Michigan, was one of the guys who he was hurt and crawled into the West Woods. And then, of course, the fighting goes back and forth, and the Southerners sweep back past him, and he's leaning against a tree. And one of the guys from, I believe it was the 1st Georgia, First Sergeant Andrews, comes over, and he feels sorry for the guy, you know? Here's his counterpart on the Union, and you'd think he'd be like, kill this guy. But no, what they do is they stack cordwood. He's leaning against a tree, and they stack cordwood in front of him so he doesn't get hit by more bullets. Afterwards, the guy's leg is amputated. He survives. He goes on to become best friends with this guy in Georgia, and they stay friends for years after the war.
Yeah, that is a neat story.
Yeah, it really is. It shows the compassion involved during this violent action against one's brother. You know, there's still some kind of feeling and emotion and connection.
And we got a lot of interesting stuff around the West.
Oh
Woods.
My God, you and I went in there and that. The captain from Maryland.
Yeah, so we walk in, and the Westwoods are just, what is it, just north of the church?
Yes.
They just, and behind it. And the church felt very civilian. I didn't get any soldiers in there, but I walk outside, I'm like, well, the boys are out here.
Okay, I'll go closer to the microphone. Is this better, Henry?
Yeah, rock star. You don't want me to sing. Anyway. So, yeah, it's...
That's Kat making all the noise.
Yeah, that's me. There we go. So, So I walk up there, and I get this intense feeling of guys just watching me, just crowds of people watching. And it was the same way when I was driving through last night. I could just feel all eyes on me. And Kat, you're nodding like, yeah, I got that too.
Always.
Yeah, and they were in this one particular area of the West Woods, and I kept pointing, going, they're all in here. So eventually, Pat, you went first, and I just followed you in.
Yep.
And we did Passover ceremony?
Crossing, right.
Crossing,
we crossed over some of the soldiers there, and we asked them if they wanted our help.
Yeah.
Because not always, they don't always want your help.
And they're kind of stunned, because unlike Gettysburg, you don't have people doing crossings.
No.
So, and I get a lot of younger fellows here versus Gettysburg. and they just don't know what to make of what's happening. So, yeah, we crossed approximately 40 soldiers over, and it was interesting because I think it was you, Pat, that asked, where are you from?
Right.
And I just automatically answered, Maryland.
Yep.
And as a note for our listeners, I made sure I came to Antietam blind. I don't know the history.
Right.
And just like Gettysburg, I did not know the history. I don't even still know what the ranks, like the patches on the different clothing mean. And I do that on purpose because if I encounter someone and I can describe them to Pat or Doug or Kat, then we have more information to back up that maybe
makes it more valid.
Yeah, yeah. And that happened later with a different battlefield area. But
well, it happened there because we didn't know about the Maryland thing. And then we walk, after we got done with this, we walked back up to where the monuments were, and there's a big monument saying Maryland Brigade, you know?
So, I'm like, well, oh, okay.
And we clearly heard the captain's rank.
Yeah.
Captain and then a name, which we'll have to work on, see if we can get that up. But, you know, you were describing him standing there.
Yeah, I got a physical description of him.
And, you know, I asked him to come forward, and I saluted him, and he came forward, saluted back, I think.
Yeah, he did.
And it makes it easier to cross them over because now you've got their leader. You just tell the leader, okay, here's what we're going to do for you guys.
Yeah. And the thing was, near the end, we're crossing everyone over. There's no one left. And he and, what is it, a sergeant that would be under him?
First sergeant would be in, or sergeant major.
Yeah. And they're just standing there next to the gate. And I'm like, hey, you guys can go now. You can go in the gate too.
Right.
And that's why I had to bring it up.
Yeah.
Because they were just standing there. And I'm like, you can go too. There were three guys, three young teenagers, really, that, oh, yeah, they loved Kat. but... Yeah, they just refused. They were not going to go anywhere, and they're still hanging out in these woods next to two latrines. Great place to hang out,
nice
boys.
Nice little porta potties.
Yeah,
but well, they were just being teenagers.
They were being teenagers.
You know, they're if we told them to do something, they're not going to do it. You know.
And Henry, you had someone walk up on you.
We was by a monument, and we were. Doug was sitting down on the monument. I was standing there beside of it. We had our recorders going. Doug was asking some questions. I asked some questions. And when we listened back to it, it sounds like people just walking right up behind us, like in a bunch of weeds or something like that. And we wasn't going anywhere. There wasn't anybody else around. About 20 feet from us, though, there was some underbrush. There were a few leaves on the ground, but even after that, I walked around on the leaves. You couldn't hear any sound being made because what was down there was kind of still damp, wet, and it wasn't that many on the ground to be making that. But it was a clear somebody walking in the weeds, and there wasn't anybody back there.
Yeah, that area was mowed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's from Henry.
Yeah, that's from Henry.
And
nothing happens to him.
And when I did the EVP, we got confirmation it was yes.
Oh, and before we heard that, on the recording, it sounded like a bunch of gunfire.
Yeah, we got that a lot.
And I said, oh, it sounds like gunfire. And you said, no, it was something else. But then you got that yes on there, confirming that it was gunfire.
He asked me if it was gunfire. And I said to you, I said, well, gunfire would have more of a cracking sound to it. And then when we did the second EVP, that's when we got the confirmation. We said, is it gunfire? And then you get the EVP that says yes.
Yep.
So, plus we heard cannons in the distance. So.
And we heard that three or four times today.
Now, I'm not sure if it was cannons or motorcycles backing up, like backfire or something.
No. That one, only that one was when that tractor was.
Yeah, it was a tractor. It was a factory.
It did a backfire. That was completely different. But
that's
when
true.
We were over on the cornfield area and we heard that thing that sounded like that's a cannon sound.
That's a cannon.
Okay.
And I was convinced they had maybe a demonstration there that day, today, but they didn't.
Yeah, and I know I heard it multiple times.
Yeah.
I think it's the New York Monument that looks like a rotunda, the gazebo.
Right.
Yeah, because there was a moment when you guys went to go get your cars, and I just walked from that gazebo monument over to the church. It was right across the street.
Right.
But I could hear cannon fire, and we heard it, and I noted it quite a few times over the course of our day. The place we went to after that was Northwoods, and Tabby, you had an encounter there?
Yes, about 6 years ago, I had someone actually come to me almost in a vision. And at first I wasn't exactly sure who he was or why he was coming to me, but it was almost like I was in a waking dream. I could actually see this Union officer. He was on horseback, and he was going down a slight incline from my right to my left, if I was looking at it like I was looking at it on a screen or something. And I could feel his emotions. He was just gut-wrenched over something. And even though he was sitting upright in his saddle, his head was down, and I could see a couple of white buildings off to his right, but when he was looking over to his left, he was overlooking a field where there was just nothing but carnage. There were dead horses, a few leftover dead soldiers, and you could smell it, you could feel the tension in the air, and I had no idea who this person was. But then I was sitting there one afternoon, and my hand started writing, and it ended up doing a writing that was not mine. It was not my handwriting at all.
You were automatic writing?
I was automatic writing and didn't even know it. And I sent emails to Pat with that same writing, and it said that his hat was off, hats off, and his name was either Peterson or Patterson. And at that time, I had no idea who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier this year, the same exact thing happened to me without the automatic writing.
Okay.
And I still didn't know. So then Pat kind of gave me a clue as to where it may have been and so forth. So I did some additional research and came up with John Williams Patterson of the 102nd Pennsylvania. But I still didn't know where on the battlefield this was supposed to take place.
Mm-hmm.
So when Pat directed us after the Dunkard Church over to that area, it was like I was seeing it all over again in my head, and I just got overcome. It was just incredible. It was,
yeah,
I could feel him.
Yeah.
The buildings were the identical buildings of the dip in the road.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting chills just thinking about
it
now.
Well, and
it's
you were overlooking
incredible.
The cornfield, which is one of the bloodiest parts of the battlefield, where men died in rows and by the dozens, and the cannons literally blew men to pieces. So that's the vision to your left would have been the cornfield.
Yeah, and what was interesting about this particular officer was that he had been wounded in a previous battle and had only arrived back on the battlefield into the Army in active duty the day before the Battle of Antietam. And yet he really wasn't in command necessarily, because he was still more or less recuperating. But I'm sure that the reason that I felt the way I did is because he had such remorse at not really being there for his men and seeing the carnage and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, a year later, he was killed in the Battle of the Wilderness.
Right.
Wow.
But it was just interesting that why he came to me, I had no clue. And if it weren't for this particular excursion, I probably never really would have picked up on it. And Pat, I thank you for that.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
No, that's the north end of the battlefield is a place people kind of overlook, because you got the sunken road, Bloody Lane there.
Yeah.
And then you have the bridge. So everybody gravitates toward that and the Dunkard Church.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the battle started on the north end of that, where we were standing at that farm, Joseph Poffenberger Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I pointed out to Henry where I was sitting on a rock one day when I got the EVP that told me I was sitting on top of an unexploded shell. But it ties in with the history, because if you know, the artillery duel started on the morning of the 17th in the fog. And where we were standing, the rebel guns were overshooting and going into a field. Just, we could see the field right there. And a lot of the shells weren't exploding. They were burrowing into the ground, and the fuses were bad. And there actually is a story about a dog who was chasing the shells as they came flying in, and he'd run over and bark at them and paw at them. And unfortunately, one went off when he did this, and the dog was wounded.
Wow.
Yeah. So that end of the battlefield is where everything started. And this artillery duel was supposed to be even worse than anything they saw at Gettysburg, because they're firing point blank into fog. They don't even know what they're firing at in some cases.
Yeah. And actually, to lighten the mood, Henry had a great quote. Great, great Henryism. Lights just went out in the kitchen that we're broadcasting from, so that was interesting. But Henry's great quote, we're standing on, what was it, the cornfields?
Oh, the Eastwoods, near the Eastwoods.
And he looks and he goes, did somebody die here? It was at a roadside memorial.
Yes.
For a, let's see.
Private James.
Quarter.
Quarter or something, yes.
Yeah. Who?
46 Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And I was, it, we just all looked at him. We're like,
did somebody die here? It's clearly a grave marker, you know, and you're on the battlefield where 23,000 people died, Henry. So, yes, somebody died
here.
But no, Henry, he was a real trooper, despite the fact that we marched him farther than he's walked in probably 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the experience of being on the battlefield. The infantry had to walk.
Yeah. They did. So that brings us to the Bloody Road. And you let us not... So we get right out of the parking lot, we go down the stairwell, and you're in the sunken road area.
Yes.
And I immediately go, there's something. Something happened right over here to my right. But you lead us left and down a different trail. I'm walking down the trail, and I look up, and I see a man's head pop up from the crest of the hill, look at us, and immediately... go back down like he was
prone.
Like lookout?
Prone, yeah. Not like a lookout, but doing the little army crawl.
Yeah.
On the ground. And I mention it to Pat. I turn around and go, I just saw a dude do this. And he just looks at me and gives me the smile that you just gave me right there. And you're like, okay. And we just keep walking.
Yeah.
And then tell me what you told us.
Okay, so we get up to this spot I wanted to go to, and first of all, she didn't know where we were going.
Nope.
And she points up there, and she's like, I want to go up there. I'm like, that's where we're going.
Okay, yeah, so that's right. I forgot about that.
So, sees the guy peeking up over the hill and going back down. So I proceed to tell her, well, the story here is that in the sunken lane, their first two attacks by the Union were unsuccessful. Then the Irish Brigade was brought in, and the Irish Brigade... comes to the top, there's a crest of a ridge before you even get to the sunken road, and the Confederates had actually come to the top of that ridge and were fighting from there. The Irish Brigade pushes them back off the ridge, but once they get to the top of the ridge, they're now exposed to all the fire from the sunken road.
Mm-hmm.
They come under a tremendous amount of both cannon fire and rifle fire, and what do? They all hit the ground just out of sheer preservation. And if you're next to a guy in line and you see your first sergeant hit the ground, you're going right down too.
Yeah.
And so what the Irish Brigade did is they stopped there. They all hit the ground and they're laying on the ground. And then General Marr, who was the leader of the Irish Brigade and a little drunk at the time, he takes his horse out in front of these guys and they're being fired at. There's bullets whizzing all over the place. And he says, grabs the flag, come with me, boys.
Mm-hmm.
Let's show them what we got. And he leads a charge, and everybody gets up, and they run like crazy, but they're bent over like in a hailstorm, because now the Confederates are firing everything they can. And they take tremendous losses, but they come within 30 yards of this sunken road. And that's when the muskets they had with the buck and ball, 69 caliber ball, and three smaller shots called buck, was like a horrific shotgun and blasted huge holes into the Confederate line. And somebody is turning the lights on and off in the kitchen as we are speaking here.
Yeah.
And it's
Doug,
not
can
a
you
human.
Check them out?
You know, we don't think.
Sure the brownies aren't ready?
I hear a beeping now. Is it the.
That was interesting.
That's...
So the Irishmen actually get down there and they pour a tremendous fire into the Confederacy. Confederates give it right
no,
back.
They're not doing them?
That's funny. So we have just confirmed that, yes, the lights are going on and off.
There's a spirit in here turning the lights off and on in the kitchen.
They're seriously really wanting our attention then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Calm down, guys. We'll get it in about 10 minutes. So,
would one of you like to say something? You got this little microphone right here. You can come here and say something right now.
The beeping is from this mechanism.
Is that like maybe an automatic off switch or some kind of
I don't
timer?
Know.
Yep.
Oh, the lights. Lights just went off. All right. So it could be electrical.
Okay.
It's electric.
Okay.
Aw, rats.
Darn.
All rats. And
more rats, double rats.
Henry, are you killing more bugs? Yes.
Ew.
Okay,
yeah.
Now.
So, and it was at that ridge where I saw the Phantom Horse and Rider.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm shooting away with my camera, and I just happened to look down the trail, and it was where the trail crossed with a paved trail just before the roulette farm. And I saw a man with a hat, I want to call it like a cowboy hat, but it was a brimmed hat, and his horse. And I saw him for about 2 seconds, and then they just faded away.
That brings you to Tabby Cat, who saw the soldier all the way down in the back of the field line with the flag.
Yes, it was probably maybe a good 500 yards down along the tree line. And I saw movement, and then I saw a flag come up. You could see the top of the flagpole. You could see the American flag, you know, the red, white, and blue, and part of the stars. And it was bobbing up and down like somebody was walking. And it went for maybe 30 feet. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of went down, disappeared.
And it was gone.
Well,
we did another crossing there.
Yes.
And I don't think it was quite as successful as our first one. We didn't get as many guys.
Right.
But we got a horse.
And, we did get a horse, which it's not the first horse I've done. But,
really?
No.
Wow. Oh, my God. That was do you really think anybody needs to know that, Pat?
There's a Henryism. I don't know why Henry didn't say
that. Yeah, he's just shaking his head. Arms up in the air.
One of the stories from the Irish Brigade is about a guy named Captain Duffy, Captain Felix Duffy, of the 69th New York. And as the Irish Brigade is heading toward the top of this hill and they get over the crest, there's a bunch of trees in the area, and the Confederates were up in the trees and were picking off the color guard and the officers to create as much havoc as possible. So the Irish Brigade, having those Belgian muskets that fired the buck and ball, can't shoot them from that distance, and they can only march. So Captain Duffy had bought his own rifle, rifle that can shoot 300 yards. And he grabs that, and he goes out in front of the brigade as they're marching, and he runs up and he shoots a sniper here, shoots one there. He gets, I guess, 6 or 7, maybe 8 snipers before he's killed himself. And so he completely selflessly puts himself out there knowing this is going to happen, but knowing every sniper he gets that's a rebel means more guys are going to live, more officers won't be shot, and the color guards won't be shot. Mm-hmm. However, the color guards are shot, the 69th New York, they're shot 8 times within about 2 minutes.
Wow.
The 63rd New York, 11 times. So as you're walking forward, the color guard's going down, somebody else is picking the flag up. And this poor Captain Duffy had run out, trying to save these guys, shooting the Confederates out of the trees until he gets shot. So I thought, let's try to talk to Captain Duffy. And we did. We made contact. We actually got the name Captain Duffy.
Yep.
And that's a hero to me. So I said, Captain, we're going to help you out. Is that something you want to do? You want to go to heaven? Yes. Help. Yeah. They said, help me. So I had him line his men up, and we opened the portal. We get the guys going in there, and somebody grabs a horse and takes the horse in.
Yeah, it was interesting. So I'm watching this through my mind's eye and helping them cross over. And I saw a man pick up the reins of a horse and lead the horse through. It was a brown horse, and it had a white patch on its forehead and a black mane. And I just remember thinking,
That's different.
And that would have been an officer.
Yeah, it probably
fairly high-ranking officer.
Yeah, I didn't see what his clothing were, but we saw Confederate soldiers, and we have EVP to go with them.
Yeah, all the ones that wanted all of a sudden they wanted to join in.
Yeah, so we were doing the crossing. It had been at least 5 minutes, and Pat's like, "Okay, is that everyone?" And in my mind and in Kat, both of us, I think, shot a look at each other. Maybe. Yeah.
And I'm going, wait, no. Pat, there's a couple of guys back here that want to go.
And I turn around past Kat looking behind me, and I caught a glimpse of a young Confederate soldier, his cape flapping in the wind as he dashes meters and goes right between Kat and I and goes right into the gate, the portal.
Yeah.
And the doorway, yeah, whatever you want to call it.
With that said, if the EVP I got during your crossing over says "save me," could have been that Confederate.
One of the three, because right. Kat, you saw two others come from the same hill, but they passed by you, didn't they?
One of them passed by me. The other one passed in between us. One that passed on the other side of me, I could feel him. I mean, there was an extreme cold breeze that went past me. Mm-hmm. But they were so anxious to go. But they waited until the last minute, waiting for the Union guys to go through first. And then all of a sudden, there was like, wait a minute, wait for us.
And,
you know, can we go too?
And then on your recorders, we got corresponding audio.
Yeah.
And what did they say?
We got that.
Well, they were saying, "Save me," and, you know.
And then we got to hurry.
Hurry.
We got a really gruff hurry. And
double time? What was it?
Oh, yeah. I often, once I have the officer give the command to forward march into the portal, I often throw in a, you know, "Come on, guys, hurry it up on the double quick," which is a Civil War term they would understand. And they often do. And back then, the officer would hear it from his officer, repeat it, and then the sergeant would repeat it, and we're getting on our EVPs all day today. When I did say "double quick," right after that you'd hear somebody repeat the command, "double quick."
Right. Well, guys,
that's better than double Nestle's quick, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be tasty.
We've had a lot. I hope that you liked the show tonight.
Yes. Yeah, we got two minutes
left. We've had a lot of fun. We're getting to ready to start wrapping up.
Yep, and we're going to start investigating.
Yeah.
Yes. So, Pat, why don't you say a little bit about where people can listen to you guys at?
Well, except for tonight, which we're off because this is a holy day to Doug and I, you can listen to us on rockwiththeshock.com or hooveradio.com every Saturday night at 10 o'clock till 2 in the morning. Great music and fun.
Very good. Jeff, won't you get...
jeffpool.net/2011pnv.htm. Our personal website is theparanormalview.com. At Facebook, do a search for The Paranormal View. There we are. Community, not magazine. I'm saying this fast because the last 2 weeks, my stuff hasn't really gone out of the air. You can also follow us on Twitter, as Kat will tell you. I'm on Twitter at Real Badger. Expect dark and twisted humor. Sorry. So there you go. And I never got to say about the fact I was actually on a Civil War War Between the States battlefield last week in Missouri, the Wilson's Battle Creek.
Well, cool. We'll talk about
next week, has it?
I get that.
So, also, my information, www.catklokow.com, KatKlokow. See me at Rhode Island Comic Con next week in the Artist Alley. And also, if you go to my Periscope, which is at KatKlokow, KatKlokow, I will probably be videotaping the Pry House. And you only get 24 hours to watch it, folks, so, yeah.
So, good luck if you only have 3G.
Yeah, good luck.
With that, we will see you all next week at the same time. We're fixing to run real quick, like. So this is Henry Foister,
Jeffrey Gould,
Barbara Duncan,
Kat Klokow,
Doug McReynolds,
Pat McCormick,
Kat Gash,
and we will see you next week at the same time. So happy Halloween and good night, everybody.
Stay spooky.
Happy Samhain.
That's right, the Celtic Festival.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You've been listening to The Paranormal View. on the Para-X Radio Network. Join us again next week at the same time for more of the Paranormal Universe.